Joining me on Beyond the Playlist is John Bagholt. He is a producer, composer, arranger, musician. John, how you doing?
Very good. How's everything going?
Good. It's been about a year since we spoke last. And it's good to always catch up.
Time flies so quickly.
It does. It's funny.
Like, it sounds like a week ago, you know?
It's funny how a year can feel like it was a week ago. Yeah. But also, when you think about it, it was a year ago and a lot's happened.
Oh, yeah. No doubt. No doubt. Yeah. That's the understatement of the century. Right.
We've had the pandemic lockdown.
Yeah.
We in Salt Lake had earthquakes.
Oh, I saw that. Yeah. Welcome to the club.
Yeah.
Being in Los Angeles. Yeah.
And then now we have the murder hornets that are on the way.
Right. I've heard about those. I think those are interesting. We'll see where they show up.
Well, I hear they're only bound to higher elevations, which means Salt Lake.
Oh, interesting. Oh, yeah, exactly. Yeah, Salt Lake.
So,
right.
But the reason we're gathering here again today is because another Pattern Seeking Out Animals album has come out. And you told me that you said you had three albums that you were going to release in 3 years. And here we are midway through your process.
Yeah. Well, three albums in 3 years. That gives me 2 more years to release the next one. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's kind of like the, they always say about the Kennedy assassination. You know, they say, well, no one could have shot 3 bullets in 6 seconds. Well, they say, yeah, that's 1 every 3 seconds. No, because you start the first one, then you start the 6 second clock.
Yeah.
So when I say the three albums in 3 years, I still have 2 years left for the next one. But the third one should definitely be much sooner than that.
Well, so your first one, I thoroughly enjoyed and I really liked it. And I have to say, this new one, the first track, just right off the bat, I'm like, holy cow, this is a whole new level of mixing and engineering and songwriting. What happened in between that get you kind of to bump up?
Well, I think the major difference is when we did the first one, it started off as being some songs I just had around, some things I'd written for other people or of my own. I'd done as demos. And I thought, well, there's, two or three songs, I think it was, I'd just like to hear real drums on. I got Jimmy to play on it. And within the time between we scheduled the session and I asked him, I wrote some more songs and I talked to the other two guys and said, hey, you're interested in just recording this stuff and we'll see if anyone's interested in it. And then they were. So the band wasn't even formed until the album was mostly done. And we didn't even know it was going to be released. So I produced it like it was going to be an album, but the songs were kind of from different areas. Where this album, I pretty much started from scratch. And I said, okay, this is going to be for the album. Everything's going to be written to sound alike. There were a couple little riffs and things I took from earlier songs I did that didn't go anywhere, a soundtrack at one point. But essentially, everything was written from scratch, from go. And I just thought, at first, the idea was, which we probably would have done on the first album, knowing at the beginning it was going to be an album and a group, I wanted to add some other instruments to it. So I thought, well, I'm going to write this stuff so we can add other instruments, like violin, trumpet, flute, sax, all that kind of stuff. Not just adding it on at the end, with someone coming in and putting parts over it, but, writing the material from the start, knowing that that stuff was going to be in there. So that was the thing. And then the way it was written, I would finish one song and then, okay, well, the next song is going to be, let's make it sound. First of all, it's not going to sound like the first song I wrote, but it has to sound like it's on the same album. So I think it's this consistency of making everything from the start, like it was from the same, frame of mind or from the same, not necessarily the same viewpoint, but everything sounds like it's going to be from the same album. And I think a lot of times for a lot of people, when you write material over the years that it ends up on an album, I think most writers anyway, change over time. And something you might have written for an album you started 4 years ago might sound like it's from a different, viewpoint or whatever from the song you're writing right now. You might be using different sounds or different approach. You might have had different influences pop in. So I think everything was written quickly, and that helped the overall vibe of the album, I think.
Well, the other thing that I found really interesting is the first album had a particular sound to it, and this one sounds like it's bigger and thicker and richer, and it uses more of the sound palette than the first one did. And I'm not saying the first one was bad. I'm just saying I instantly noticed this sounds bigger. This sounds like it had a bigger soundscape to it.
Yeah, I was going to say that was part of it. I wanted to make it just sound like it was, and I'm not saying deeper in terms of philosophically deeper or lyrically deeper. But you know, when you're sitting at speakers and there's more depth to the music, uh-huh. you can also like reach your hand through it. It's full, but it's more three dimensional.
Yes, exactly. That's exactly it. The first song, I have these studio monitors that sit in front of me because of podcasting, yeah. and I hit play on the first song and I'm all of a sudden kind of surrounded and knee deep in it. It was around me instead of in front of me. It was awesome.
Yeah, that was the way it was written. And then with Rich, we spent a lot more time in the studio while mixing, coming up with stuff. And where the first album, for example, a lot of the acoustic guitars were from my original demos, and we just put them in there. And they sounded fine in the mix of the first album. I'm not putting it down at all.
Yeah.
But for this one, we got in there. And we would listen to my acoustic guitars and thinking, you know, it could have been recorded a little better, you know, because, and it's just, you know, it might have been, you know, 5% better, but we thought, let's just go with it. Let's record it specifically. Let's mic it different, spend a little more time. Because I think a lot of times, I think with the first album, so there's demo parts in there. Again, not to disparage anything that I or anyone else did, but a lot of times demo parts end up in the song, which is great. This one, From the start, I knew that every sound we put down was going to end up on the album. We knew this is going for an album and we're going to go for a certain vibe. And so a lot of times we would get into the studio with Rich on this one. And I would think, boy, my acoustic guitar, I wasn't playing too tight there. The sound wasn't great. So we just recorded again. And we would just sit there in the studio and record the parts again or come up with some new parts. You know, he'd mic me up and I played the part, or he played a couple parts. So yeah, I think there's more time spent. And I also think by adding the real instruments, you know, in some of the songs, that helped a lot of it. But I like the idea of the depth, and I like, you know, the transparency, I guess you would call it. Yeah. I just don't like mixes to be claustrophobic.
Yeah. And when you're dealing with projects like this, one of the things that always kind of comes up in the conversation is financing and money. Did the last album do well enough to pay for this one, or...
You know, I don't even know how much the last, it did okay. The deal I have was there's an advance, you know, for each album. And the first album essentially was paid for, you know, I think it went a couple bucks over just by a few. It was pretty good. And there's an advance for the second album. And I got the money for the second album. And I ended up going I'm going to say $8,000 or $9,000 over that out of my own pocket because I just thought, you know, why am I going to cheap out on some of these sounds? And, you know, I just want it to be perfect. I just want it to not as good as it can be. And just what I'm hearing. So if it took longer, well, that's what it took. So I went for it. And the thing is, you know, with bands, I'm sure you've heard forever. Yeah. They get advances and it's very rare. You end up making money on the physical sale of albums, at least for a few albums in, you know, if you're a new band or whatever, because even though you know, first of all, they have to recoup the advance, any record company recoups the advance. And then on top of that, there's all sorts of expenses which go into the category of has to be paid back eventually, you know, through the end of time, you know how it is.
But
for the most part, it was pretty much in budget, even though I went over on this one. It's like, it's okay. It's fine. It wasn't tremendously. It wasn't like one of those things you hear about people where they went hundreds of thousands of dollars over, you know, nothing quite that extravagant. So, but no, I was happy to go a little further.
So how long did this take you to get to in production? I mean,
I started right. We turned the first album in, I think, in February of 2019. I think February or March or something like that. And then it was released in July. And I started writing right away. So February of March, April, I wrote, I think there was 7 songs altogether. 7 or 8. And then in May, we recorded all the drums. And we just kept working and working. And we got lucky in the sense that, you know, for the first album, there was one period where Rich did live sound for, you know, Neil Morse's band, and he was gone for 2 months. So all of a sudden, there's a big gap where I was just kind of sitting around thinking, okay, not much we can do now because Rich isn't here, you know, to get the mix or whatever. This time we got really lucky with scheduling. So everyone came up with their parts, got them all in. By summer of 2019, everything was in progress and everyone was doing their parts. And we did one more drum session because there's a couple songs which, not that they weren't good, they were sounding like, and they were too similar to other songs. Mm-hmm. So I ended up at one point saying, okay, we need one more song and we need a closing song. So I wrote Soon But Not Today was the last one I wrote specifically. And I wrote that one pretty quickly to be the, I think that came in September, October last year. We did the drums for that and finished that. So from start to finish, the mixing was probably done in January. So from February. So I think it took about 10, 11 months start to finish.
And these aren't, and many of these songs aren't your, you know, your radio friendly ditties either. I mean, you're talking
right.
songs. I think you've got what, one or two that clock in around 4 or 5 minutes and the rest of them are seven plus.
Yeah. Soon, but or not soon. Elegant Vampires and Why Don't We Run, like 4.5 and 5 minutes there. The first couple are around 8 minutes each, but, and again, that was there's no intention of doing it like that. When I write, I think a lot of prog guys, they'll say, okay, now I'm going to write a 20-minute song or whatever.
Yeah.
To me, that's real. I've tried that before, and it's tough because you end up going, well, I'm already 10 minutes in, and I'm already bored of it. But I said it was going to be 20, so I got to you know, scrape it together. But I just write until the song is just done. I'm either bored with it or I'm thinking, okay, I've said everything I can say in this one. Let's just end it here. So they just end up as ever long as
they
end up being.
I think the idea of releasing limitations, if you can write a complete thought in 4.5 minutes, then good on you. That's a 3.5-4 minute thought. But if you've got a mood or a conversation when you have musically, then saying, okay, I'm only give myself 20 minutes or I'm only going to give myself 15 minutes for this. You could be cutting yourself short and losing something in there that could have really worked. And I think that kind of that idea of writing to a time or writing to a thing can really limit yourself and kind of set you up to be frustrated.
I think there's, it can go both ways. To me, a lot of times, the more structure I need to write something in, if someone says you need to write a 3.5-minute song about trains. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But I was saying, yeah, if someone says you write a song about trains and that's to be 3 minutes long, it's very easy to write.
Yeah.
And if someone says, you know, birds in New England, 6 minutes, minor key, easy to write. So on one hand, the structure is good sometimes. But for this band and this album, I never start with anything like that. And I don't think, you know, I think when you write for other people and for other situations, a lot of times when I'm writing anyway, because I listen to so many different styles of music, if I'm writing a prog tune and all of a sudden something says, you know, it'd be really cool to do reggae here or you know, some kind of an Ethiopian pop thing, whatever it is, I just decided from the get-go, I wasn't going to limit myself as far as what styles and what direction you went in. You know, it's like there's a couple songs, you know, which you've heard, you know, some reggae pops up.
Yep.
Or some, you know, not country, but almost like spaghetti Western stuff. It's kind of like, well, if it sounds good, it is good.
Well, and that's the thing that I really liked is like, I wish that there was more spaghetti Western in regular music because that twangy guitar, like the Duane Eddy / spaghetti Western guitar, that's got to come back. I don't care who does it, but somebody's got to do it.
Oh, yeah. No, I love that kind of stuff. In fact, there's one I'm working on the next album. There's a lot of that type of stuff happening. I love that whole vibe. And there's so many great, you know, I think there's so many great aspects of different types of pop and folk and regional music, whatever you want to call it, ethnic, that it just isn't explored enough in other types of music, especially prog. I think for, you know, it's one of the great ironies that when people say progressive, which should mean you take all sorts of chances and go in all sorts of directions, but so many times it's so confining. You did this, that's not really prog, you know, that's only this because you did this. And it's like, well, wait a second.
Yeah,
you know, is it, we're talking, you know, capital progressive, capital P progressive, or small p progressive. So I think a lot of Prague starts to sound inbred after a while. And sometimes that's great, because there's nothing better than hearing something like Romanesque of old Genesis and it's done really well, or you know, whatever. I'm thinking, oh, that's really cool.
Yeah.
But sometimes you hear other stuff and it's just a little too derivative and a little too, you're thinking, boy, if they would have just done another road or something that wasn't so obvious here, it might have been more interesting.
And also, but sometimes writing challenges for yourself where you're like, okay, I'm going to cram reggae against against a techno beat at some point. And and then you cramming genres next to each other. I want to go flamenco to, you know, 4/4 metal or whatever you want to do. There are things that can happen with those personal musical challenges you write for yourself that you could never get if you didn't challenge yourself.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And I agree. And because I'm not a great musician as far as a player, my whole thing is the studio and producing. That's what I love to do most. I'm not sitting there thinking, you know, I'm sure to the consternation of the other people in the band, I'm not sitting here thinking while I'm writing, well, are we going to be able to pull this off live? I'm just thinking what's going to sound best in the recording. And just whatever's going to cost the best come through the speakers while someone is sitting here at home, you know, listening on headphones or speakers, whatever. That's, to me, the ultimate goal. And then later we figure out how to play it live.
Yeah. So speaking of that, have you ever written a band into a corner with something?
Oh, yeah, I'm sure I have. I'm sure some of the stuff I did with Spox, they got annoyed. But I would tell them, because they would say, well, how are we going to do this live? And I said, well, you figure that out. My goal is to make a good sounding record. If I have to sit here and think, oh, I can't do that because, you know, the keyboard player needs three hands or you need three guitar or whatever, you know, that's just not, you know, it's not my problem. it sounds horribly, you know, horribly selfish, but ultimately, you know, you want the best result coming off of the album as you can.
So I think that should be a shirt that you make that says, I'm a composer, it's not my problem.
Yeah, not my problem, the producer.
Yeah.
I mean, if you go back and listen to, you know, I think maybe the best example is, and not to compare myself to the Beatles at all, but I was just reading in the paper today where there is some little, you know, friendly feud going on. You know, Paul McCartney says the Beatles are better than the Stones, and and the Stones and Mick Jagger come out and said, hey, we're still a band, we're still playing. You know, the difference between the Beatles, take the Beatles and the Stones in, you know, right before, like at the end of the 60s, the Beatles had given up playing live.
Yeah.
And you take anything off those last few albums and to put those things across live, because they just couldn't, because of all the noise and the sound systems weren't sophisticated enough. It, you know, Sgt. Pepper's, they would have needed 10, 12 players on stage to be able to do that to justice.
Yeah, it would look like Slipknot meets a symphony up there with as many people and all the instruments. Yeah.
And no doubt it would have been just a killer concert. And it would have been great if back, you know, they might have stayed together longer if they could have pulled that stuff off live. But the sound systems just weren't, they couldn't handle it with all the screaming girls. They couldn't hear themselves. And that's why they got all of their great influences and just inspiration to do all the stuff in the studio, because they were free of thinking, oh, we have to play this stuff live. But bring it back to the Stones and the Beatles. Beatles would have been impossible to play that stuff live. And the Stones, you could have taken any of those Stones albums at the five of them at the time, or whatever, I guess there was four, whatever there was in those albums, and they could have pulled it off great live, because that was what they went in the studio with. It's just like a band playing, you know, a couple of guitars, bass, and drums, maybe Nicky Hopkins on piano. And it would just sound, all their stuff would sound great live. I think it's a different philosophy of how you record stuff.
Yeah.
And I just went into it not even thinking that we have to play this live. And consequently, when we got to the point where we had to think of how to play it live, we had to come up with a couple other musicians to go into the mix, because it's, you know, without having to play the tracks or without having to pare things down to do it right. But yeah, to make a long story short, it is kind of freeing in the studio not having to consider that.
I'm sure Alan Parsons had the same thing when he was doing Alan Parsons Project, because there are lots of things he pulls in that you can't recreate live without bringing, you know, 35 people on stage.
Oh, yeah. And you have those great albums where, you know, all of a sudden, what is that, an iRobot, which is the one where he's starts out with the zither, or the hammered dulcimer.
Yeah.
And then there's five or six different killer vocalists and all that stuff. And then you have horn sections and strings. Yeah, same deal. But again, I think he was in a position, At the time, later on, they went and played that stuff live. But I think when he did all that stuff, he wasn't thinking, we got to pull this off live somehow.
Yeah, I don't think they started touring until much later in their career.
Oh, yeah. I think maybe he got bored and thinking, hey, maybe now with all the technology, maybe we could pull this off. So 20 years later, obviously, he was out playing live, which is great.
Yeah.
I just love it. Alan Parsons stuff. I just love all that stuff.
Well, part of the thing that makes this album successful and you confident that you can write something and hand it to people and play are the players you have. And you've mentioned Jimmy, but kind of talk about the players again and who you have on this so that people kind of understand the talent pool you're working with.
Yeah. Well, besides obviously the band, Ted Leonard, who's the lead vocalist and guitarist. You can't say enough about him. And he's such a great guitar player. Underused in the other bands he's been in because he was a lead vocalist and in bands with incredible guitar players. So he would play every once in a while, but there was always someone else kind of in the spotlight as far as guitar. And I just wanted to bring him in to the band as playing guitar since he's so good, whatever he does. Then obviously Jimmy Keegan on drums and vocals. And what I love about, Ted and Jimmy's vocals is such a great blend. And that's one thing on the album we did. We worked a lot more on the vocals and bringing those out, more harmonies. To me, you just can't have enough harmonies and, cool parts and stuff like that. Jimmy, then Dave Maros on bass. And again, he's just the best. He's a great bass player, super intuitive, plays exactly what's needed. And what's nice on this one is that I think if you were to go on all the songs, he's playing different basses throughout everything. And there's different bass sounds, from the first song to the last. He just, he pulls out some really cool stuff on this album, I think.
Well, and that's the thing that's nice is you've got people who are versatile musicians. It's guitar player, singer, drummer, singer, bass player. And I think, doesn't Dave do some harmonies too?
Dave did a few on this one. He did some things with some of the group vocals on the last song. But most of the harmonies was Jimmy and Ted, and my voice is in there occasionally. But it's such a full sound. If Dave was around, because he did all his parts at home up north, I'm sure he would have added to the vocals. But when he was down and we were doing some other stuff, he laid some backing vocals in. Besides the band members, we had some other people playing on it. The violinist, her name is Rinny, R-I-N-I. She lives in New York. And I was kind of looking for something a little different. And she plays fusion, but she also plays Indian classical in folk music. She's Indian. So she has this really cool vibe to her playing, a little different than most violinists. I just like her style and the way she played and that stuff. On flute, a friend of mine I've known forever, Susan Craig Winsberg, played on a bunch of tunes. And trumpet, John Fumo, again, great player around town here. He played trumpet and flugelhorn, I think two or three, maybe three songs, I think. Besides that, a cellist named Michelle Packman and a couple songs. And then a sax player. I've never met in person. I found him online, played on Lifeboat. He played baritone sax and tenor sax, which is really cool. So yeah, I wanted to beef up the real instruments, which I think helps distinguish it from the first album. It's just kind of a different vibe to a lot of it with the real instruments. Yeah.
Just as it said.
And I have to say that I think the baritone sax is one of the coolest instruments. But when take it, when you take it and just have it playing on its own, it basically is a tuned fart.
Oh, yeah, exactly. The best part. Yeah, right. If you listen to it, it mixed with other things, you just hear this really kind of low, grindy type of thing, which is, it's such a cool sound. But by itself, it's kind of blatty and blary. And it can still sound cool, but within other things. It's all the way through the last 10 minutes of Lifeboat or whatever that is, most of the last 8 minutes. And it's just such a cool texture.
I'm sure there are not that many Barry sax solos, but they do work really well.
Yeah, Tower of Power.
Yes, exactly.
But there aren't that many. But I didn't go for any solos on it. It was purely to get the vibe of the baritone sax, that whole sound, the texture in the lower range, which I really liked.
Yeah, I could actually, a friend of mine plays didgeridoo. And it kind of does the same thing where it kind of fills in that bottom with a vibration that makes it adds interest.
Right, exactly. Yeah, didgeridoo is a cool sound. But by itself, you listen to it for like the first minute, you're going, oh, that's interesting. Then after a while, it's like, well, okay,
yeah.
Now what? But it's a really cool texture within music. It's didgeridoo is great. I know someone who used to build his own didgeridoos.
Oh, wow.
It was really cool. Yeah.
Well, as you went through and were writing these songs, the nice thing about them is you said you wrote them all for the same album. So that means you were thinking about using the same sound palettes and some of the same reoccurring themes and things like that as far as the songs went. What were they? What was your driving force behind it? What were you trying to say as you wrote these things?
Nothing. Boy, you know, I didn't have trying to say anything particularly as a whole.
Well, good. Everything has to say something. So own it.
Yeah. I would write one song, and when I say it was meant to sound on the same album, I'm thinking I didn't want something so wildly different than, you know, when one song ended, the other one started, you're thinking, well, is this a different album? Is this a different band? Which is, it's very easy to do sometimes.
Yeah.
But I just thought, okay, I'm going to make it sound like, there's some, obviously you got the consistent sounds. Obviously Jimmy's drumming is solid and consistent all the way through his style, the bass playing. So a lot of the keyboard sounds, you know, would go, I used a lot of bell sounds, Mellotron, stuff like that. But then I would expand with all sorts of different synth sounds. And obviously the vocals, I also approached it, like I said, where it's more three-dimensional. I wanted to do that on all the songs. So it's powerful. I didn't want it to be too ambient where you kind of lose the edge to it. But I just didn't want it to sound claustrophobic, like I said. So that was part of it too, just to make it sound. A lot of that comes in mixing as well. But no, each song when I started, I'm thinking, okay, where do I want to go here? Is it a lyric thing I want to do? Is it a musical thing? I would just start and without anything in my head thinking, well, it's got to be this, it's got to be that, it's got to be down tempo, up tempo, it's got to be whatever. I would just start a song and so consequently, I would start a song and get five or six false starts. I'd get a verse and a chorus in, and I'm just thinking, oh, this is like pulling teeth. It's not working. So I'd trash it and start again until something reached critical mass. I'm thinking, okay, this one's going. This is going to be a song. And then I would finish it. But I think the other problem, I think I used to get into a lot. I think a lot of people do. Luckily, I'm pretty prolific as far as writing because I write every day. But I think the tendency sometimes is when you start to write, you're thinking, well, I've worked on this song a week and I'm only 2 minutes in and I'm not crazy about it, but I got to keep going because I've invested all this, you know, all this time. But it's like the old saying, throwing good money after bad. At some point, you just got to cut your loss and say, you know what, this ain't going anywhere. I don't care what I do to this. It's not going to get better. So you just say, okay, I'm trashing it. You know, for another time, if or whatever, I'll just erase it and start from scratch. Because you know, realistically, you know when something's going to work and something's going to pan out, and when it doesn't.
Okay, so this next question has got two parts to it. One of them is: so if you write every day, how do you keep yourself sounding unique? And then second, how do you make sure that you are, or how do you challenge yourself to break free of this? The basic song structure that everyone knows, you know, verse, chorus, bridge.
I'll tell you, I think that's a tendency to do because we all grew up with the, you're right, the pop song, verse, chorus, verse, chorus, bridge, verse, or maybe a verse, maybe no bridge, but very straight ahead pop structure. I listened to a ton of different types of music. And one thing which started happening, which I really liked in pop music and K-pop and all that kind of stuff, is to make things sound unique and fresh, especially in Asian pop. They started doing these structures which were very, very different, and builds and how you get into a chorus. And sometimes there's two totally different choruses. And I started thinking, okay, I consciously made an effort not to go so much into that verse, chorus, bridge type of thing. I would repeat some sections, but I don't think on this one, on the shorter one, they're more structured. It's more verse, chorus, bridge, whatever. On the longer ones, though, I resisted the temptation to just take a pop song and stretch it out into 12 minutes long or whatever. I like writing more linear. Mm-hmm. You might come back to a theme every once in a while, like a melody or a hook or something, but you're not just going to come back and a big chorus repeat at the end. I didn't really want to do that. I wanted it to move in a linear fashion, which I think both Lifeboat and Suma Not Today do, as well as Raining Heart in Heaven. That's a pretty bizarre structure if you listen to
it. Yeah. Well, it's interesting too. I'm thinking about the structure of songs. I remember for a time there was a hot minute in pop music, and I can't exactly define when. It might have been in the early 80s. Uh-huh. When songs would start with the chorus and then lead to the verse. And I always thought that was interesting because it kind of hit you up front with what was the catchy part.
Yeah, that's a good songwriting craft move. I did that. In fact, Here in My Autumn, it does that. It starts with the chorus. It's a great thing because it comes from, I think the Beatles did it a few times, and it does happen every once in a while. If you got a really great chorus, why wait to put it out there?
Yeah.
You know, if you start it, you know, and if it's something you want to say something, whatever you're saying in the chorus, it sets up the lyrics in the verse that way. Here's the chorus. Now I'm going to explain what I mean and what I just said in the chorus. It can go the other way too. Obviously in a verse, it builds up the chorus and it pays off. But a lot of times if something is really hooky, you just set the standard by starting the song with the chorus. And then you start messing with the structure later. You don't automatically go to another chorus after the second verse. You might go to the bridge and, you know, shake things up. I kind of like doing that. But I think to go back to what you're saying, I think it's important. It's a good point. I catch myself getting into that standard verse, chorus, bridge type thing because I'm so into pop music. But I'm thinking, okay, I'm writing something different now. Do I want it just to sound like a pop song someone went in with an industrial compressor and pumped a bunch of air into to stretch it out to 10 minutes long. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like, okay, it's a 4-minute song, but I'm going to put a big instrumental section in the middle and just, you know, it's going to be a 4-minute instrumental bridge and come back to the regular pop chorus again. I was trying not to do that.
Well, so as a progressive composer and producer, how do you control those musical interludes so they don't just sound like musical masturbation?
Very easy. Because it's very easy to write that kind of stuff and it sounds great. What I do, and I've made my, it's I think it's a discipline. I'll get to a song and I'm writing. And when you're writing, you're just listening to it hundreds of times a day because you're going back and forth. And if I write a section like that, and all of a sudden I find myself fast-forwarding through it, I'm thinking, it doesn't need to be there. Because if it's not interesting me after hearing this, you know, a bunch of times, it's going to wear on the people listening to it. It's not, you know, it's just not going to stick. So you just start editing. You cut, you know, a few minutes out here, a few minutes out there. And, you know, it's great if you have a band full of great soloists and stuff, cool. Yeah, you do a few minutes of solos back and forth, but that's not what, you know, we're trying to do with this band.
No, yeah, and I know that. It was a question that popped up because you do have a 20-minute epic on here. And
yeah, well it's only 17 and a half, but still close. well that song is interesting in that it started when I started writing it, I was thinking it was done at around 5 minutes. And I'm looking at the lyrics thinking, you know, maybe it might be interesting to just tag on another section at the end here where he's, you know, the guy's in the lifeboat. and we don't know what happens. Maybe he starts thinking back on his life. I said, okay, I'll write a little more. And then I started thinking, well, what happens if I go back to when he's a kid? Yeah, all of a sudden, I keep writing more sections. And then now he's back in the boat and we don't know what's happening. I thought, wow, this song's getting long here. But there came a point at the end of that when I thought, yeah, this one's done. This one's done. And there were a couple of sections in there that I did take out along the way, a couple instrumental sections where I wrote them. Because it's real easy. Sometimes you're sitting there writing and it sounds great to you. And you come back the next day and you're thinking, what was I doing here? This is bad. It's not working. You see, you need a little distance. But it is tough to be subjective or tough to be objective with this stuff because you're so involved in it. And you got to resist the urge, like I said, to say, geez, I spent the whole weekend on this 1 minute. Am I just going to trash it now? Yes.
But the thing is, you probably hang on to some of those notes and maybe they'll be used elsewhere.
Sometimes, yeah. It's kind of like, but on the other hand, a lot of times I keep a journal of lyrics. Lyrical ideas, like most writers do. If I'm driving around and I think of something, that's a cool line, I'll write it down. So I have this file going. It's probably 30 pages long of just idea lines and words and cool things. You just got in the habit of when you write, of putting these down for future use. And I think, oh yeah, I'll use this someday. I'll use this and I'll use this or whatever. And then same thing with music. At the end, when I do an album, I'll go through it. I said, okay, I'm going to just weed through it and get rid of all the stuff I used. And most of the time, I use almost none of it. You know, I might use one little phrase and then just take off from there. I write these whole things where I never end up using this stuff because it just doesn't work and it's not quite right for whatever I'm writing. I think most writers are like that. Something which might have sounded good at the time when you wrote it down, you can't find a way to use it musically. And musical ideas, too, which might have been really cool little passages within something else you had to take out for one reason, just might not be that great on their own. Without something else going into it or coming out of it to make it flow right, it's just as easy to write sometimes a new piece.
Yeah.
Here's a perfect example. One of the songs, which actually didn't end up on the album because it was too simple, it will end up on the next album. It's one of the last ones I wrote. But we needed something different for the end. Was a song I had written 25 years ago in a band I was in called Orphan Moon that Dave was in, female vocalist. And it was a song when I wrote it at the time. I kept thinking, I don't think my songwriting chops are to the point of really making it as good as I thought it could be, right? And you get to that point where you look back at something and you think, oh yeah, I should have done this and that. But at the point, you just weren't thinking the same way or you weren't, whatever. You didn't have the ability to do it or your mind was in a different place. And I kept hearing that song and thinking, you know, it didn't really work. You know what? I bet, let me just take it and I'll just, if I could just rework the chords in the verse, I think I could just make it better just for my own satisfaction. So I sat down with the guitar and I started playing with it and I wrote an entire new verse for the song. I thought, this is really cool. But now the chorus isn't really fitting. So I took that song and I replaced the chorus. And now, of course, the bridge didn't fit. So what started out was me just tweaking a couple chords in the verse turned out to be an entirely different song that has nothing in common with the first one, except for one chord change. It's still the same in the chorus. It's because once you start writing and changing something, it's like puzzle pieces. All of a sudden, well, this part doesn't fit now. And I've got to change this because all of a sudden this doesn't work. So that song, it's funny because when I hear it, I'm thinking, oh yeah, this is a song 25 years ago, but there's no way in the world anyone would ever, who knew that original song, would think this is at all related to it.
So I've got two things. One, I love the album cover for this. How did you find that piece of art?
Again, what happened was because this album happened so quickly, what normally happens is, it's Thomas Eberhardt, the great artist who's done a zillion covers for Inside Out and did all the Spock's covers and all that stuff. You get together with him and you say, okay, I have some ideas, need to throw some ideas back and forth. And over a couple months, you throw ideas back and forth. All of a sudden, it was getting toward the end of the album, and I'm thinking, oh, they're going to want to put it out in July. And I said, no, we have a space open in May, but you need to turn the album in February. And all of a sudden, there was a month to go and no time to go back and forth. So I talked to Thomas, and I said, hey, if I come up with some existing artwork, you can just build the album cover around it. He goes, oh, yeah, no problem. We do it all the time. So I started going through a bunch of different art sites online and Instagram, and I came across that artist, Mirek, M-I-R-E-K, a Polish artist who's kind of a surrealist photo art. And I saw a bunch of his pieces that I thought, God, any one of these would have just been a killer album cover. You know, just one of those guys. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, I'm going to contact him. And the one that ended up on the cover, I thought, that's the one I really want to use. I just hope. I emailed him and I said, is everything available for an album cover for licensing? He said, well, some of them aren't, but send me a list of what you're looking for. And I'm thinking, oh, please let this one be available. And luckily that was one of the ones available. So I just licensed it and it was just perfect as it was. It's just such a cool piece of art. Yep. It's very evocative.
Yeah, I think. It is. And the other thing I wanted to say is when you get all the three done, can I make the request, recommendation, personal dream that there might be a 5-1 mix of a greatest hits? Because I really think that with the music you're writing and working with Rich, having it be some immersive 5.1 stuff going on could really be an enjoyable listening experience for those who are, you know, into it and willing to do it.
Yeah, I think, you know, I've thought about doing that. I just wonder, I think it becomes a question of how many people are really going to get into it and buy it.
Yeah.
When at the amount of what it would cost to mix it like that, because it wouldn't be a cheap thing to do.
No, it wouldn't.
I mean, we did the 96K mixes, the high redness mixes at the same time. So those are out there. You know, and the other problem, I think, with 5.1, and this is personally because I never listen to music in 5.1. I don't have a setup. It doesn't interest me. I get totally why people are into it. But, you know, I'm the guy who listens to everything on iTunes, and I don't care if they're MP3s. I don't listen to vinyl. I'm just there to hear the music.
I'm very much that person, too. Music is music. Listening is listening.
Yeah.
And enjoying is enjoying. I'm not an audiophile by any stretch. But for the stuff I really like I bought... In Abstentia,
the
Porcupine Tree. They had that art book series with the DVDs and all that stuff.
Sure.
I bought it specifically for the 5.1 mix of that thing because
that's
an album that if I put it on my home stereo, turn up the volume when no one's home, turn the lights down, I'm in it. And it's something special to behold.
Now, I see. I can totally see that because that's an album where Stephen Wilson, the way that is done, it's a, again, what we were talking about before, it is a lot of depth to that album. Some of those those big clean guitar washes, they're just depth. And you can see for miles in that mix. It's just big and clear and shiny. It's that album sounds so great. But here's the deal. Since I don't think in terms of 5.1, and I never have, and at Rich's studio, it's not even set up to mix 5.1. I suppose we could do it, you know, set up the speakers, but it's something that doesn't even occur to me. Maybe just because I never got into it, but I've been asked that several times. You know, why don't you do this? I'm thinking, it just never pops into my head.
It wouldn't be something you could do for every album. It'd be prohibitively expensive.
Right.
But if you're doing like a compilation hits of the three together and some kind of box set thingy with some other stuff in it that for collectors, it could be a limited run kind of thing. There could be something there that you know, your diehard. I mean, you've got one in me, I'd buy it.
I understand people be into it. And I completely understand why people are into it because the times I've been in situations where I've heard it, it's really cool. It's phenomenal to listen to great albums. I love to hear that In Abstentia album and that. But it's just not something which naturally is in my head thinking while I'm writing.
Yeah.
And I think the other thing is that I just get so involved in the writing and sitting in my studio and I write everything in headphones pretty much. I'm just there dialed into it. So I'm not thinking along the way of, wow, I better shoot some video while we're doing this so we'll have something to put out later. And, it never occurs to me and I know it should. And it'll be like, we're mixing. I think, oh, I should probably turn my iPhone on and just shoot some stuff of Rich. And luckily the guys from the studio, we were doing some studio, you know, some group photos at the end. I shot some video, some minor stuff. But, you know, I look at these other bands who put this stuff out and there's full making of. It's like they had a video crew in there while they were recording everything. Mm-hmm. I think, wow, that's cool. But it just never, it never occurs to me. And even when I think I should be shooting video, I'm trying to pay attention to the music. So I get very easily distracted thinking, oh yeah, I should have been taking a video of that violin player, that flute player. That would have been cool. But oops, I totally forgot. I was thinking of the music. Yeah, I know.
The first time I heard the opening track, The Raining Heart in Heaven, I'm like, this could easily be a 5-1 mix. And I would love every second of that. Like the opening 2 minutes of it are crazy.
Yeah, you know, I think the way to do it would probably be to give it to someone else to mix, someone who does 5.1 mixes specifically, mm-hmm. you know, and say, okay, here are the stems, here's the guitar stems, here's the bass, whatever, and then have them do that. I probably couldn't be involved because I don't do it that much. Everything would sound good to me. You know, it's like, oh, that's really cool the way you're doing that. And then they'd be going, well, no, I haven't really even done anything yet. I haven't really moved it to where I would. That's not even the right speaker yet. But it would sound cool to me because I'm not used to hearing it.
Yeah.
And it would just sound great. So I wouldn't be the one to do it. Let's put it like that. Because it's just, I don't have the experience to do it.
Well, why don't you tell everyone where they can find the album, keep up with you, all that kind of stuff.
The best way is if you're on Facebook, Pattern Seeking Animals, there is a Facebook page. There's a website, PSAnimals1. PSAnimals1.com. And if you go to Twitter, it's PSAnimals1. If you go to Instagram, it's PSAnimals1. You can find us pretty much in all the social media. Videos, we're coming up with a new, I don't know when this will be out, but we have a new video coming out for Why Don't We Run May 29th. So that'll be out there. And we had the video for Elegant Vampires, which is out on YouTube. And we're just going to be putting out a lot of stuff over the next few months, whether it's the new performance videos or some playthrough videos we'll be doing with Jimmy playing drums. Ted will probably do one or two for guitar, and we're just going to bombard the social media airwaves with as much material as possible.
John, I really appreciate you coming on again next year, same time.
Sure. Absolutely. Next album. Just contact me, you know. We'll see. I'm already writing number 3, so we'll see. We get lucky and everyone's schedules line up and everything, but I think it probably will. But we'll see.
Yeah. Well, I really appreciate you coming on again. I love talking to you. It's kind of turned into a thing now, so I appreciate it.
Sounds good. Yeah, I appreciate it. And look forward to hearing this when it comes out. I'll post it everywhere. And good luck with everything.
shadow that your heart should never trust. Resurrected men, now monsters, from medieval tomes appear, seeking out memento mori as they wander through the years. These strangers come and go, dressed all in dead men's clothes. They'll steal your broken heart slowly. This night the moon won't blow, like blood the darkness flows. The end is near.
For more Beyond the Playlist with J. Hammond C., you can go to jhammondc.com. You can follow me on Twitter at jhammondc. You can email the show at jhammondc@gmail.com. The theme music is by Magnus Ellegren, featuring Jimmy C. and the New York Brass. The cover art is by Phil Rude. You can join the Facebook group for Beyond the Playlist with J. Hammond C. You can find this and other fine shows streaming at Alpha Geek Radio. If you like what you hear, you can go to iTunes or Stitcher and leave a review. Thank you for listening to Beyond the Playlist with J. Hammond C.